Penguin Random House Canada presents The Tenth Nerve, A Brain Surgeon's Stories of the Patients Who Changed Him by Chris Honey, MD. Read for you by the author. Forward. For most people, neurosurgery is a mysterious, high-stakes profession. That's part of the reason I was drawn to it as a curious child, and eventually as a medical intern and doctoral student. Even after centuries of medical exploration, the brain, lying hidden and protected beneath the skull, is rarely seen and only superficially understood. It is the precious organ responsible for our thoughts, movements, and personality. To operate on the brain invites the danger of changing the very essence of the patient. Not a casual endeavor. After practicing neurosurgery for more than 25 years, I wrote this book to show how a brain surgeon operates, literally, and to share the human stories behind two significant discoveries by my team at Vancouver General Hospital of previously unrecognized but likely ancient diseases. In recounting these events, I realized that some of my patients had profoundly changed who I was. Here, then, is a book about discoveries, both medical discoveries that I have provided my patients and personal discoveries that my patients have prompted in me. These are the stories of seven brave individuals whose close encounters changed me into a better person and surgeon. The scalpel can only go so deep, and technical skill can only take you so far. Real understanding of an illness requires listening and genuine care. The Tenth Nerve is a book about curiosity, the wonder of the human brain, and the courage of a few remarkable patients. In the 1500s, when medical knowledge and treatments were limited, doctors provided more emotional support than medical cure. The French surgeon Ambroise Paré, 1510 to 1590, famously said, "The physician's duty is to cure occasionally, relieve often, console always." Nowadays, these duties have been reversed in importance. Doctors are expected to cure always and leave the consoling to the nurses. On the first day of medical school, the cadavers have their faces and hands wrapped in white linen to limit any emotional engagement for the would-be physicians. This practice enhances the ability of the students to dispassionately cut into the bodies and learn their anatomy. By graduation 4 years later, every student knows doctors should never become emotionally connected to their patients. We diagnose, we treat, we leave. If you are foolish enough to become emotionally involved with your patients, they will take you to euphoric highs and suicidal lows. Every day, a doctor kills themselves in the United States. In Canada, suicide is the only cause of mortality that is higher among physicians than the general public. Many factors may explain this epidemic of medical suicide, but a key one is the emotional strain of sharing a patient's fears, frustrations, and failures. Simply put, riding a roller coaster of compassion entails a very real personal risk to the physician. The current model of medicine therefore encourages a personal detachment between doctor and patient. That dispassionate approach, coupled with the time pressures of the business of medicine, often leaves the patient feeling that they are just a disease and not a person. The truth, of course, is that the disease and the patient cannot be separated. As Sir William Osler said, the good physician treats the disease. The great physician treats the patient who has the disease. The superb family doctor knows this, and every medical decision they make is framed by how it will affect the patient and their family. The virtuoso surgeon, however, need only know how to get that last piece of tumor off the blood vessel without tearing it. Surgeons are expected to be bold, confident, and technically gifted. sometimes wrong but never in doubt. In our weekly neurosurgical morbidity and mortality rounds, cases are discussed in an effort to prevent medical errors from recurring. The chief resident begins. This 49-year-old brain tumor had a craniotomy with gross total resection last Monday and a few days later developed seizures. The fact that the patient's wife thought he would die and will always remember him shaking uncontrollably is of no relevance. We discuss only why the nameless 49-year-old brain tumor developed his seizures and whether we could have prevented it. Emotions, we are taught, are an impediment to the best practice of surgery. But despite all our training to be detached and rational, sometimes a patient does leave an indelible mark on your soul. That is why my first story is about an infant named Saika, whom I operated on in Tapita, Liberia, someone who completely changed how I practiced medicine and how I viewed the world. I now realize that despite my learned, dispassionate approach, a few patients have profoundly changed my understanding of both medicine and myself. In short, they have expanded my understanding of what it means to be human. Chapter 1. Saika. I touched down at Roberts International Airport on the outskirts of Monrovia, the capital city of Liberia in West Africa, in the late evening of March 31st, 2014, as part of an international aid mission that would perform the first neurosurgical operations in that country. The team supporting this effort was the Korlebu Neuroscience Foundation, a group of nurses and physicians, initially from Vancouver General Hospital, had helped set up and equip a neurosurgery service in neighboring Ghana. The director of that foundation, Marge Rattel, learned that Liberia had never had a neurosurgeon and wanted to set up a satellite clinic. I had been to Ghana on several occasions to help their neurosurgeons, so she asked if I would come along and help in Liberia. Our plan was to identify a local general surgeon who was interested in the field and help train them to provide this care for Liberians. We knew that to fly in, operate on a few patients, and then leave without training someone to carry on the work would be a futile drop in the bucket. We needed local buy-in. Inquiries to the Liberian government revealed that the Deputy Minister of Health, Dr. Francis Keita, happened to run a hospital with the only CT, computerized tomography, scanner in the country. The Jackson F. Doe Memorial Regional Referral Hospital was located in Tapita, about a six-hour drive east of Monrovia. This hospital had been built by the People's Republic of China. It was inaugurated on February 7, 2011, as a gift from the country and came fully stocked with a variety of diagnostic machines. Around the same time, the China Union Mining Company secured a 25-year iron ore mining agreement from the Liberian Prime Minister, the Nobel laureate, Ms. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. In anticipation of our mission, the foundation had sent an African neurosurgeon from Nigeria to the Jackson F. Doe Hospital a month earlier to see patients and identify some for potential surgery. He saw more than 200 people. At least a dozen were now waiting for their neurosurgery if conditions were right for me to proceed. This would be their only chance for the surgery they needed. Without treatment, most would suffer paralysis and succumb to a shortened, painful life. While I was flying across the Atlantic, these prospective patients were living in large, open-air ward rooms with their families who were cooking and cleaning for them. I spent the first night in a hotel room in Monrovia while we waited for transportation to the hospital on the other side of the country. Monrovia is named after the fifth American president, James Monroe, who had supported a policy of migration of free African Americans to the continent of Africa in the 1820s. Some 4,500 emigrated, or were forced to emigrate, by slave owners afraid of the concept of free people of color, and by white supremacists who could not imagine.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?